The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record. The Diamond Cutter Scriptures, Scornful Revilement. The Pointer. If you take up one and let two go, you're not yet an adept. Even to understand three corners when one is raised still goes against the fundamental essence. Even if you get heaven and earth to change instantly without rejoinder from the four quarters, thunder rolling, lightning flying, clouds moving, rain rushing, overturning lakes, toppling cliffs, like a pitcher pouring, like a bowl emptying, you have still not raised up a half. Is there anyone who can turn the polar star, who can shift the axis of the earth? To test, I cite this old case. The Diamond Cutter Scripture says, if one is scornfully reviled by others, this person has done wicked acts in previous ages, which should bring them into evil ways. But because of the evil and vilification by others in the present age, the wicked action of former ages is thereby extinguished. A poem. The clear jewel is in my palm. Whoever has accomplishment will be rewarded with it. When neither stranger nor friend comes, it has utterly no abilities. Since it has no abilities, the evil one loses their way. Gautama, Gautama, do you know me or not? Suedo also said, completely exposed. Good morning. This weekend, Shōen Osho and I were leading a retreat on the precepts. And in the Eight Gates, Dada Roshi says, in essence, the precepts are a definition of the life of a Buddha, or how Buddha functions in the world, how enlightened beings live their lives, relate to others, make moral and ethical decisions, manifest wisdom and compassion in everyday life. At the monastery, the precepts are the basis of the rules and guidelines for all residents. For those practicing away from the monastery, precepts provide a way to see how the moral and ethical teachings in Buddhism can come to life in the marketplace, relationships, government, business, ecology. The precepts are unique among religious ethical teachings in that they are based on the experience of no self, and that experience makes all the difference in the world. So we looked at how these teachings are, from the very beginning, the Buddha's own original teachings are essential to Buddhist practice, to meditation, to enlightenment, to everything that Buddhism teaches. And as Dada Roshi says, they're based on the experience of no self, selflessness, emptiness of self, and that fact, that realization makes all the difference in the world. And so what is that basis? In the pointer, there's this very poetic and rather dramatic list of all these miraculous abilities, and yet still, that doesn't even reach a half. But can you turn the polar star, shift the axis of the earth? This is not about a magical, supernatural display of powers. In fact, in the Zen tradition, that can be seen as a distraction, should you be so endowed with such powers. What makes all the difference in the world is realizing our self-nature, the unborn, undying body of the Buddha. Here, we're freed from self-clinging, from fear, from anxiety, from cruelty. This koan is interesting, I think, and on different levels. It's kind of startling. It hopefully gets one's attention. It's also, it's a direct quote from the Diamond Sutra, which is a one of the essential sutras of the Prajnaparamita body of teachings, which is one of the most, as one scholar said on the back of one of the translations, one of the most important bodies of religious teachings ever in human history. It's vast. The Heart Sutra that we chanted this morning is a part of that body of teaching, which is even more succinct. The Diamond Sutras has a little bit more pages to it. And then there are successive sutras of counted by lines, 8,000 lines, 15,000 lines, 25,000 lines, and so on. And so this is a direct quote from the Diamond Sutra, and it's speaking about karma. And so that's why I wanted to, thought it'd be good to bring it up this morning, the conclusion of this retreat. And there are a few, there are a number of koans that speak, draw directly from a basic Buddhist teaching, right? So here, quite explicitly, from the Diamond Sutra, it's presenting a basic Buddhist teaching about karma, and which means that it it brings into the koan that basic fundamental understanding of karma in Buddhism. And that's not actually what the koan is about. Or rather, that basic understanding that I'll speak about is a lot of what we talked about yesterday. It's how to understand karma. How can it be spoken about? How can we gain understanding of it so that we can practice well? The Buddha said, if we don't understand karma, it's going to be very difficult at best to practice well, because we will continue not understanding the nature of cause and effect. We will continue to play out deeply held habits of mind and emotion and reactivity, which will bring forth the same consequences, and we won't understand why. We won't understand why is that happening. And so the Buddha said, we need to understand as deeply as we can. And he said, the nature of karma is so deep, so profound, that only a fully enlightened being can fully understand. See, sort of into all of the web, the strands of karma. But as practitioners, we can understand it deeply enough to help us. And so that basic understanding is brought out. But the koan, as is almost always the case, and interestingly, in these cases where it brings out a basic teaching, which could be explained and understood, but it's looking at it at the fundamental level, not at the level at which it can be explained, not at the level at which basically everyone understands, who understands Buddhism or karma in Buddhism can speak about that or understand it, but at the basis. Because that makes all the difference, as Dada Roshi said. Otherwise, if that wasn't important or necessary, we wouldn't need to do the meditation that we do. Certainly not to the extent that we do it. We wouldn't need to do much of what we do. We would need to just study the teachings, learn them, change our behavior. But even that, you know, I mean, that in a sense is telling us that when we try to just change our behavior, even if we change the behavior, other things don't change, because there's something at the fundamental that is unchanged. That's why the Buddha said developing concentration, samadhi, has a temporary transformative effect. It's calming, is really important, but it doesn't actually pull up the roots of our false views. It doesn't really liberate us from our clinging. The Buddha said in an early sutra, I declare, students of the way, that actions willed, you know, those arising from an intention, performed and accumulated, will not become extinct as long as their results have not been experienced, be it in this life, in the next life, or in subsequent lives. And as long as these results of actions willed, performed, and accumulated have not been experienced, there will be no making of an end to suffering. So this is really important, and this is very much a part of this understanding of karma, that intentional action through our thought, through words and actions, brings forth a consequence that is our basic concern in Buddhism, because it's arising from a desire, which means it's arising from my mind, which means it's arising from the way I see things, from my attachments, from my sense of self. It's laden, it's dependent upon and laden with my own entanglements. And that desire then comes out in my thoughts, words, and actions, and then that becomes part of its consequence. And so the teaching is that when the consequence to that action manifests, as he says, Shōhan Osho talked about this yesterday, the teaching of three times, it might happen in the near future, in the immediate moment, it might happen much later, or it might happen within traditional Buddhism and in Buddhism in a subsequent lifetime. And part of the teaching of that is that karma is not optional, basically. I'd rather not participate, if you don't mind. Like, that's not an option, that in the human world, every intentional action has a consequence, will bear fruit. So as we talked about, the idea that, you know, can I get away with this? Can I do something that I want that, you know, basically goes against the precepts or what is good and suffer no consequence? And Buddhism says, no, not possible. How and when that consequence comes up, we don't know yet. We'll see when it arises. And so that's a way of helping us to have faith that the idea of getting away with something is a waste of time, basically, right? Much better to clean up our house, to live well, to develop compassion. And so when that consequence arises, that's the moment. It's like a propitious moment, because the seeds, the qualities of that action that I have committed continue to exist in me, right? Until the consequence arises and have force and be influencing me. Until the consequence of that action, the result, arises within me, within my life. And now is my opportunity, as the Buddha said, to liberate myself. He speaks of extinguishing, of freeing, of dissolving those seeds so they don't continue to manifest. And so that depends on how do I meet that moment. If I've done something out of anger, and the consequence of that is something that brings anger with it, towards me, and I respond again with anger, well, then I'm just taking those seeds and planting them again. But if I respond in a different way, compassionately, with mindfulness, awareness, with an avow, then they begin to dissolve. Those energies are transformed into something that is life-giving rather than taking away. That's why when we are in the midst of those strong emotions, Shōhan Osho talked about the kleshas, these very strong, afflictive emotions that are the basis for our actions as they overtake us. That's why it's so important that when those arise, and in a sense, the stronger they are, the more important it is, although sometimes the more difficult it is to practice them well, because from a Buddhist perspective, that's how the karma of those kleshas begins to transform, and that's always available to us. The Buddha said, if one says that whatever way a person performs a karmic action, in that very same way they will experience the result, in other words, in that case, there will be no possibility for a Dharma life, and no opportunity would appear for making a complete end to suffering. But if one says that a person who performs a karmic action with a result that is variably experienceable can be experienced in different ways, then they will reap its result accordingly. In that case, there will be the possibility for them to live a liberated life, and an opportunity would appear for making a complete end to suffering. So what he's saying is that karma is not determined. It doesn't determine It's not deterministic. It's not fatalistic. It's ongoing. It's always in process, which means we always have the ability, the opportunity to shift, to turn, no matter how intractable a situation or we ourselves or someone else might be. And that's really important, right? It's why the Bodhisattva doesn't suffer defeat. We might have moments where we feel defeated, where it might feel intractable, it might feel hopeless. But really what's happening in that moment is, in a sense, we're indulging, we're sort of getting mired, right, in an emotion, in a thought process, in an imaginary world that doesn't actually exist, in which we are defeating ourselves. And so the Bodhisattva recognizes that, right? Takes another breath, takes another step, because nothing is fixed. Isn't that good news? Hell yeah, it's good news. So think about the variable ways in which we can experience something. So I say something that is hurtful to you, and you respond with injury, with hurt, right? And I see that, and I don't care. And I walk away, right? I say something that is hurtful to you, and I see that land on you, and you're hurt, and I'm deeply hurt that I have done that. That isn't what I want. That isn't how I want to be in the world. That isn't what I want my effect to be on you. I am so sorry that I said that. Let me make this right. We know those are two different experiences in the aftermath of something that I have said and now I can't take back, but the karma is still moving. The effect is not fixed. It's variable. And so the moment of action is important, but in a certain sense, from that moment, what's more important is what happens next. Well, Chinese master said, karma is a residual force of action. Whether actions are good or bad, they depend mainly on the mind. Thus, the presence of strong wisdom or resolution can cause karma to change. And that means the consequence of karma, because karma is the initial action. Karma means what is possible, not what is predetermined. Hence, it can be transformed. Thus, Buddhism stresses past karma, but does not fall into the doctrine of fatalism. So obviously this koan is taking up this question, this reality. In another early sutra, the Buddha said, both formerly and now, what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering. If others abuse, revile, scold, or harass the Buddha for this, then the Buddha on that account feels no annoyance, bitterness, or dejection of the heart. If another honors, respects, reveres, and venerates the Buddha for that, then the Buddha on that account feels no delight, no joy, no elation of the heart. Now, we might really just immediately appreciate that he isn't crushed by the criticism, but it's like, oh, but we'd like that elation, right? Why not that? And what's important to understand is this is not being cut off, distant. It's just not deflated by one or ecstatic, made ecstatic by the other. Right? It's a very good practice when we are being scolded or criticized or hearing difficult words. Right? It's so easy to see the self arising. Right? It's like a body practice. You feel the energy arising. You might feel a virtual wall of defense arising within you. You might see that your argument is already forming. Right? And to just see that as a protection, a threat to the self. What is being threatened? And to just let that relax, breathe, listen. actually hear the words, take them in, right? Even if the person in front of you seems out of their mind, there's probably some truth. As practitioners, my job is to hear that, tease that out, so that I can see that. What about this is me? What can I learn? What is being reflected back that I can apply and benefit from? And in doing that, then I often see what remains. Maybe that doesn't belong to me. Maybe that isn't something I need to take up. And so not to be deflated, and at the same time, Dada Roshi used to say often, don't believe in your own press notices, right? You read the reviews, everybody loved you, right? Okay, thank you very much. What's for breakfast? So in other words, the self is not dependent upon. Last week I talked about Chosen Roshi sending this little clip about you can be a thermostat or you can be a thermometer. Right? Thermometer is my energy, my person, my temperature is totally dependent upon you. You love me, I'm doing great. You hate me, I'm doing terrible. And so, if one is scornfully reviled by others, this person has done wicked acts in previous ages, which should bring them down into evil ways. They've done something that was harmful, right? And when we do something that's harmful, that hurts others and hurts ourselves, because it always goes in both directions, we can mask, numb, distract from the harm that it's causing ourselves. But what happens with practice is we start to feel that more and more. We should be able to feel that more and more. But what's also happening is we're actually, part of why it hurts, I think, is because we're actually going against our fundamental nature. Not just how we want to be in the world, if we want to be in the world in a good way, but at a deeper level, we're actually going against our basic nature. And so a person who has done this should, by the laws of karma, fall down into evil ways. In other words, that karma should continue to drag on them. Right? It's important to understand this isn't a cosmic justice system, right? There's no punishment. It isn't a system of punishment. In that sense, the whole idea of karma is it's just the way things work in the human realm. So when we act well and good things happen, it's not that we're being rewarded by whom. You know, it's not seen that way. It's just the natural results, consequences of affirming, positive, generous, loving, compassionate actions coming from wisdom and selflessness. When the opposite is happening, it's not punishment, it's just the consequences of those actions. And so a person should be brought down into evil ways, but because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present, now, the wicked actions of former ages is extinguished. One might wonder, well, why, as the Buddha said in his own sutra, why is he, if he's teaching, would he be on the receiving end of scorn and revilement? Sometimes we don't want to hear the truth. So shoot the messenger. Another scholar said, maybe it's because this sutra, which is a Mahayana sutra, was being criticized by those of the early Buddhist tradition. Whatever the reason, it's not so important. Here. Hakuin, about this passage, said, "This has been misunderstood by many people, past and present. There is something of significance here, you know. No more can be said about it. Everyone should look at it closely someday." Very interesting. There's something of great significance here, you know. I can't say anything more than that. But someday, one day, get around to looking into it. Sometimes when you understate something, it's like a shout. So again, the teaching is that because of past actions, the scorn or violence that I'm receiving as a result of earlier actions, that is in that moment, if I respond well, that they will be extinguished. I will free myself of that karma. But what is it that's liberated? So again, that's a practice way of looking at it. That's a essential way of understanding this. That is how we practice. I mean, every moment when we are practicing and something arises that we could easily respond to out of our habitual patterns that are not helpful, and we do that, if we pay attention, we will see that it's getting harder. It's getting more difficult. The Buddha said, yeah, you might be getting a little bit of pleasure, that's why we do it, but look underneath and see the danger. But it's pointing to something more ultimate. And the commentary says, the general idea of this sutra is about the efficacy of the sutra itself and its teachings. Someone like this in former times created hellish deeds, but because of the strength of the sutra's good power, they have not yet suffered because they are practicing within the Dharma. Because of scorn and vilification by people in the present age, those wicked actions of former ages is extinguished. This sutra, therefore, can extinguish the wicked deeds of innumerable eons, changing the grave to become light, changing the light to becoming inconsequential, and so on. And there are many Mahayana sutras that talk about how the sutra itself is not just sacred, but has a power. But then he goes on to say, some say that the sutra itself has spiritual power. If so, take a volume of it and lay it in an uncluttered place and see if it has any effect on that room. He quotes Fei Yan, who said, realizing Buddhahood is called upholding the sutra. That's how we uphold the sutra, is by practicing and realizing it. In the sutra, it says, all the Buddhas and the teachings of complete awakening, of all the Buddhas, all comes forth from the scriptures. But tell me, what is it that you're calling the sutra? If the power is in the text, then all we should do is put the text in the middle of the room and just carry on as always. What is it that you call the sutra, he asks. Because of the scorn and revilement in the present age, not the present age, but in this moment. So the student of this koan has to enter into that very moment. It has to become real and alive. We create mental images and words that have meaning in our mind all the time. We make it up. Our mind is creating it. It may be about something that's right in front of us. Often it's about something that is not in front of us. It may not even exist in the world. But in those mental images and words, they have power, right? How do we know that? Because we react to them. So we have certain thoughts and we start getting aroused. We have other thoughts, we start getting angry. We have other thoughts and mental images and we become fearful. And so on. That's showing us that they take on a reality in our mind that we actually start reacting to as though they're real, right? And that's a lot of what we're trying to free ourselves of, right? Because we can just examine how much of the thoughts in your mind on an ordinary day are actually helping you. They're constructive. They're helping you gain more understanding about something. They're leading to some action. They're based in mindfulness. And then how many fall outside of those? I would venture to guess most of them. I hope I'm wrong. But most of us are just caught in obsessive, habitual patterns of thought that actually are not only not helpful, but are hurting us in multiple ways. So in a koan like this, and in much of practice, visualization practices, four measurables when you hold an image of somebody in your mind. We bring forth words and images that have power. We give them power. To make something real, the difference is you're doing this deliberately. You're doing it within mindfulness, and you're doing it in such a way that is based in something that is in accord with the Dharma, so that you can realize something that is Dharma. It's not something that's happening to you. You're summoning this very powerful capacity that we have and putting it to good use. It's kind of extraordinary, right? We might think that we have to, the instruments of our delusion, we have to like stop them and then get rid of them and go to Home Depot and get a whole new set, right? Dharma Home Depot, you know? It's probably much smaller. I don't know, maybe not. Probably cheaper. But actually we don't need to do that because we are already endowed with what we need. We just have to put it to good use. And so here the student enters into and creates that world, right? Being scornfully reviled by others as a result of my past actions in the present moment. It's happening right now. By virtue of that, the karma of that, the ongoing consequence, the ongoing weight, life of those actions is dissolved. I'm freed from them. What is that? That's what this koan is bringing the student to. When there's no defense, no wall, no liking or disliking, no pride that arises, no insecurity, no self. If those things are arising, then that becomes the stuff of what that student has to release themselves from, right? The stuff that we would normally easily respond with some of those things. So if those responses arise in the koan, in a way that's just showing them that they really are making it real. But now they have to go beyond that, right? So that when no self arises, now, what becomes of that scorn? What becomes of the karma of those previous actions? Where do they live now? What is it that we're calling the sutra? Think about atonement, right? This is a practice, we talked about this yesterday, that is really important and is really based in this fundamental truth. All evil karma ever created by me on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, now I atone for it. I don't make excuses. I don't blame anyone. I don't defend myself. I abandon everything. I abandon the self. I atone. There is no distance, no separation. There's only this. Now, what remains? There are many practices of living the life of a Buddha, as Daido said. And fortunately, wonderfully, there are many practices that we can take up at the very beginning because they're just using your voice. They're just using your mind in ways that are familiar to you, right? So we're given language that is based in wisdom before we know what wisdom is. We're given language and practices that arise out of selflessness before we've experienced that. We're given practices and teachings and invited to bring them into our own body, into our own voice, that are the manifestation of compassion in moments when we're not really feeling very compassionate. How powerful is that? And in a sense, we're taking the sutra, if you think of just all of those as sutras that seem to exist outside, and we're bringing them in, and at some point we realize what the scripture is, what the sutra is. And then you're never without it. You can't lose it. No one can take it away. And so that we have these practices that are so, in a way, accessible and you know, as I said yesterday, what's so important in that and how they work, you know, hand in glove with our meditation. Because when our minds are scattered, we can do any practice, we can say any words, and that scripture is over there somewhere, right? It's in the room, but it may feel like it's on the other, you know, across the way. Can hardly feel it, touch it. But the more stable our mind is, the more focused, the more developed our meditation is, it comes rushing right up. It crawls right under your skin. It starts moving through your blood. That's turning the polar star, shifting the axis of the earth. And so if we, you know, if we really see the relationship, the sort of beautiful and essential relationship between, you know, why do we sit in the morning before a teisho, right? Because zazen in and of itself is good. That's enough. And because there is going to be a teisho, right, we sit so that we can hear, right? So that we can hear more deeply, take it in more deeply. The clear jewel is in your palm. Whoever has accomplishment will be rewarded with it. When neither stranger nor friend appear, it has utterly no ability. When the coming and going, the liking and disliking, all the many things begin to fall away, we lose our ability in the most wonderful way. The constant self-making, world-making, delusion-making, suffering-making mind, so busy, can we please let it rest and lose those abilities? We don't need them. Since it has no abilities, then the evil one loses their way. Right? So when all the students of the Dharma in the Buddha's time were suddenly in the presence of Mara, and Mara was trying to undermine their practice, get them to lose their way, and the student says, "Oh, I know you. Now Mara has lost their way. They have no power." So I'll end with a poem. And thank you for this weekend. It was really nice. I felt very engaged and like it mattered, the subject, because it does. But it's such a gift to be in the presence of that. You know, in the early years, when things were very much the same and so different in terms of the climate of Buddhism, what Buddhism, where it was at in the country, what people understood about it, you know. And oftentimes, you know, people would come here and really, you know, we're looking, we're sincerely exploring and looking, but, you know, we're not, often not in very much. And that has changed so much. And to be able to practice together with you, and even when people are coming and they don't know yet, they don't know if, you know, if this is their path, but they are looking. And so in the place where they look, there is sincerity, there is engagement, because they want to know. And that makes all the difference. So thank you. I'll end with a poem. Dreaming yesterday, dreaming tomorrow. Today too is a dream. Dreaming sorrow, dreaming contentment. Let us dream every living creature awake. Let us dream ourselves awake. Dream yourself awake. That's a good dream.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.